Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Reminds Me of Freshman Year show. We will explain this, as always, after we do our introductions. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, a special radio wave to the hardworking staff at the MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. And with me to talk about freshman year or whatever else she deems important from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Assistant Professor Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Rick Phillips is in our Isomville Bureau trying to clean up the mess that Shelley left when she left the Isomville Bureau last week.
He's going to be there a while.
So we will not be getting traffic reports from Isomville during the show, but we certainly we will keep our radar tuned to the Haldeman area to be sure that we give you any information that comes. Since Rick is gone, I will just tell you, you can find our show at WMKY.org. And you can replay it there, download it, and replay it on your electronic device. Or you can go to HM Radio Show on Facebook, and you can interact with us. As a matter of fact, we had a radio fan to give me a diagram explaining how the Abilify MySight, the digital capsule works. Except it didn't say how it works. It just said it would start broadcasting when it hit the stomach contents so that you would know that the person had actually taken the pill. It was a great graphic that didn't tell anything, but you can look at it. And thanks to all of our listeners for enhancing our meager understanding of healthcare and medications. Our sponsor, Skin Safety. Blame it on the melanoma. These are 10 melanoma facts. And this comes from the American Cancer Society. And I thought, well, here's a melanoma quiz. And I always like to take quizzes, so I took the quiz. And
Did you pass the quiz?
You would like. Yeah, I did. But, you know, I spend a lot of time with stuff like melanoma, and I had an unfair advantage. So here we go. We're going to go through the first five questions this time, and then the second five we'll put off to our next fractional portion. And get ready for a true false question number one. And this is, number one is, one American dies of melanoma, the most deadly type of skin cancer, every day. True or false?
False.
Well, you didn't even give the audience a chance, Shelley.
Oh, sorry.
So, you are correct, though. The number, and again, if you think about it, think about this for a minute. We're talking about melanoma, the most deadly type of skin cancer. If one American died a day, that would be basically 365 Americans die a year. And if that is the most deadly cancer, we are doing pretty darn good. Now, 365 Americans is nothing to sneeze at. But in fact, in the estimated deaths in 2019 will be 7,230. So that's closer to one American every hour dying of melanoma. Now, the problem is that these, in many cases, are young people. Melanoma is a condition that can strike and can kill young people. It is certainly the most deadly type of skin cancer. Now, you put that 7,200 up against 140,000 and change who die of lung cancer. It is certainly not the most deadly cancer, but it is it is one of the top 10 most deadly cancers, and like I said, a predilection for young people. True or false number two. Now, Shelley, calm down.
Okay, I'll wait for the music to stop this time.
The percentage of people diagnosed with melanoma surviving 5 years or more has gotten better. Now, keep in mind, this is American Cancer Society propaganda. So the answer to that, number of people diagnosed surviving 5 years or more has gotten better, is
true.
True. That's absolutely right. In fact, since 1975, we have moved from 81.9% surviving 5 years up to 93.7%. Again, we're still losing around 6% of the people diagnosed, but we have very good treatments available. If we pick it up in time, we can actually remove the melanoma surgically and be done with it, cure it. But even the chemotherapy is pretty good there. Number three, since 1992, the prevalence of melanoma has remained about the same. Has the prevalence remained steady since 1992?
True.
False. Yeah. And that's the weird thing. You know, melanoma, there are still some things that I don't entirely understand. Since we have moved inside, since we have done more video games, since being outside now is a very rare thing, it is, in fact, increasing. The number of new cases in 2016, 22.7 per 100,000 population. It was only 14 per 100,000 in 1992. So why is it that the more we stay inside, the more melanomas we have? Now, you can make a simple argument. You can say, well, we get more sunburns. You know, but I'm not buying that either. I think the rate of sunburn per 100,000 was at least as high in 1992. So there's something happening that makes our prevalence actually increase. Four, compared to other cancers, melanoma of the skin is not very common. No, that is false. Melanoma of the skin is not very common. Again, we would not put this on as our sponsor if it was not very common. It is the fifth most common cancer type behind female breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, colorectal cancer, the most common. Now, again, not necessarily the most deadly, but it is a very common type. So that is false as well. And number five, women are more likely to get melanoma of the skin than men. Now, this you think about this. Your first thought is, yeah, because women, you know, tanning beds and tans and so forth. But, so you know then that that's wrong.
Right. Right.
Why would they do a true-false question that everybody gets? So actually, it is false. Men have melanomas at a higher rate, 28.8 per 100,000, than women at 17.5 per 100,000. They're also twice as likely to die from melanoma. So if we are blaming this on tanning beds, the men are sneaking into the tanning beds in fairly large numbers because they are twice as likely to die of melanoma. That means, though, that certainly the being male sex does not in any way protect you from melanoma. That is our sponsor, Skin Safety. Blame it on the melanoma. We'll have more melanoma true-false questions in our second fractional portion. Now, we have, from time to time on this show, talked about the dangers and the hazards of vaping. To recap, and Shelley, please comment your thoughts, but Health Matters feels that vaping, while it may be better than combustible tobacco that you set fire to, contains chemicals that we have never put in our lungs before in fairly large amounts, is completely unregulated, so additional chemicals can slip into that without anyone knowing. And people who will put things in their lungs without knowing where they came from, and our minds are not very bright people, and we do not recommend vaping.
Correct. I agree with all of that.
Well, and here's the way that works out. This is the reason we do that. This was the Wisconsin Department of Health Services released a memo in July, and the Illinois Health Department followed it. There have been in Wisconsin 11 confirmed cases of severe lung disease linked to recent vaping among teens and young adults. Seven cases pending. Illinois Department of Public Health investigating three cases. Every one of those, 11 confirmed, seven pending, three in Illinois, required hospitalization. Young people coming in with respiratory symptoms, they had to be hospitalized. Cough, shortness of breath, fatigue, worse over several days or weeks before admission. Some had fever, some didn't. Some had chest pain or nausea or diarrhea. When they got the chest x-rays, they saw scarring. They saw something called ground glass opacities, which is exactly like you'd think. If you saw glass broken up, then it is that sort of picture in the bottom of the lung. And those things, the bottom of the lung is obviously supposed to be clear, and instead they see scarring and pretty heavy-duty scarring, as a matter of fact. Some of them require breathing machines. Some of them did not. They were able to treat them with IV prednisone and other treatments and stabilize them, and the patients were improving. But long term, how much scarring there is, we don't know. No one has died from this so far. Tests for all infectious causes in the Wisconsin patients were negative, and Wisconsin's got a pretty good public health department. They get onto these epidemics and chase them down. So I think that was a pretty exhaustive testing to try to figure out what is putting these young people on breathing machines. All reported vaping within weeks or months before hospitalization. So they're still trying to chase down the products that they used and figure this out. Now, you know, my best guess is there was something in that particular lot of vaping product. It is not regulated in any way. No one's running any tests on the stuff, and some contaminant got in. We know the stuff you use for vaping is it's not water. It's not water vapor, but it's the stuff they use to make artificial fog in in movie productions and things like that. But it is an irritant, but it has not thus far put people in the intensive care unit like this. So there, you have some irritants anyway, but there was something else probably, I'm thinking, in this batch that that got distributed around Wisconsin, Illinois.
It could be. And I heard a blurb on the news the other day that there may be some seizure activity in young adults or teenagers that occurred in those who vaped. So who knows? There again, was it something in the batch? Was there something that shouldn't have been in there? We just don't know, but it's certainly concerning.
Yeah. And this message from Health Matters, you know, first of all, you can't consider it a safe thing to take up. I think that the idea that if your teenager is vaping, you've done a good job parenting, you have kept them from the evils of combustible, burnable tobacco by diverting them to vaping. They are putting unknown chemicals in their lungs, and purely and simply. And the results of that, the long-term results are not known. We tried, you may remember, Shelley, we had some inhaled insulin a few years ago. It was pharmaceutical-grade mm-hmm. insulin, carefully filtered, no additional products. And they thought, if we could get insulin in the lungs, maybe people wouldn't have to have shots. And they abandoned that project. It is still available, but it did not become popular, partly because you could see some changes in the lungs from the insulin. So I don't think it is a good idea to put things in your lungs, especially if you don't know where they came from, as we said before, and particularly irritants, and particularly those that are in this case, not regulated. I think maybe we've hit that hard enough, but just beware. Vaping is, I think we've kind of realized that this is not a this is not the safety, not the level of safety that perhaps it was touted to be initially. And by the way, I will look over across traffic. I'm at a traffic light or something, and I will think, my gosh, that car is suffering engine failure. You know, there's smoke and steam coming, curling up out of that car. There's a car that the engine's about to blow up. And then I realize the window's down and somebody is just smoke billowing mm-hmm. out of the inside of the car. My dad smoked a pipe and when I was growing up, and that was a situation we rode around town in. And brings back some bad childhood memories.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing about the vaping, whatever that smoke or whatever you want to call it, it does not stink like pipe smoke. Or so there's that.
Yeah. there you go.
There's my only positive.
That's what counts. We got a minute. I want to mention this. This was the U.S. Health and Retirement Study. This was 50, a nationally representative sample, 10,000 people age 50 years and older between 2006 and 2012. They gave them a questionnaire, and then they watched to see how many teeth they had at the end of 2012. Over that six-year period, 5% of the people lost all their teeth. And they said, what are the risk factors for losing your teeth? And there were two that really came out. One, not seeing a dentist. That is a risk factor. Perhaps you know your teeth are not good. You don't want to be scolded. I don't know. But for whatever reason, the people who didn't see a dentist were 2.7 times as likely to lose their teeth. And then cigarette smoking. Smokers, 2.5 times as likely to lose all their teeth as non-smokers. Please keep your teeth, see your dentist, and take a break. We're going to do that as well. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hi, and welcome back to the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Reminds Me of Freshman Year show, and I realize I never even discussed how this came about.
Yeah, there's a story.
There
right?
is a story. My wife and I were driving home. I think, you know, I've thought a lot. I think our marriage is a lot like the string theory of the universe. That is, the thing that keeps us married is not that we're in any way compatible, but rather that we have parallel experiences in parallel universes. We're driving along side by side, and she's clearly in a different universe than I am. So we're driving home. A song comes on the radio. If you want to know the song, it was Play That Funky Music, White Boy. Do you remember that?
I mean,
okay. That's when everything was funky. And that song came on.
I would
and
not
I
put
said,
that in your playlist, but okay.
I said, as we drove past a cow pasture, I said, that reminds me of freshman year. And she said, that's funny. I don't smell it. And at that point, we had to pull the car off the road, and we started laughing. And we, you know, to regain control of the vehicle, we had to, so I thought, well, okay, maybe, you know, if we go back and we talk about health care and we talk about melanoma in the 1990s, perhaps we could remind people of freshman year.
And play that funky music, white boy. Okay.
So at any rate, that wasn't worth talking about, but that was how we named the show. Our sponsor for the second time, Skin Safety, Blame It on the Melanoma, and our radio producer, Paul Hitchcock, a general good guy around town, points out that actually our number one statement, one American dies of melanoma, the most deadly type of skin cancer, every day. We said it was false, one dies every hour. And Paul says, well, if one dies every hour, then one does die every day. You just have to pick which one. And then we got confused, and pretty much that was all. We stopped talking at that point.
I think it's a bad test question. To my professional opinion, that's just a bad test question.
It needs to be. I remember getting some true false like that one, and true or false or C, none of the above,
or all of the above. Those are my favorite.
Yep. We're up to question number 6. If you spend all day in the sun, you should end up using an entire 6-ounce tube of sunscreen.
How long in the sun?
You stay all day in the sun. You should use an entire 6-ounce
like
tube of 12
sunscreen. 12 hours, so you reapply every 2 hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
A 6-ounce tube, probably, well, it depends on how, well, okay. So if it's Rick.
That's true.
And I can say that because he's not here. I'm going to say it's true.
Rick's going to go, hey, he needs a truck. But... actually, the American, it is, you're correct, it is true, the American cat, and I like the way you said it, you reapply every 2 hours, and they recommend an ounce of sunscreen every 2 hours. Again, if you are in a sunny situation, most certainly it's going to be warm, most certainly you're going to sweat, if nothing else, and you may be in the water or something like that, and in those cases, you need to reapply, and that will take a 6-ounce tube of sunscreen per day. So if you've got, as my family does, we have tubes of sunscreen that are 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah,
it's pretty clear we are below the minimum recommended application rate, and no doubt about it. Number 7. I'm going to read number 7, and I'm going to answer it really quickly because this is a bad – you talk about bad question. Number 7, waterproof sunblock at SPF 55 is not the best product to use. Now, it's not the best product. Is it true or false that it's not the best product to use?
Yeah.
And they said, well, that's true. It is waterproof sunblock at SPF 55 is not the best. And here's what they said. According to the FDA, sunscreens can only resist water, so it's not waterproof. And they also can only screen, not block. So we're now in the double not true section. And why would you put in a question if you say something that doesn't make any sense like that? Also, no evidence of additional benefits once you get to a sun protection factor of more than 50. So it should be water-resistant sunscreen at SPF 50.
Right.
Rather than waterproof sunblock at SPF 55. And I don't think I learned anything. That was very
disappointing. That was a bad question. We all agree that was a bad question.
Sunscreen products with an SPF of at least 15, preferably more than 30, protect against a broad spectrum of rays, UVA and UVB. That's what the FDA recommends. All right, number 8. A person with a darker complexion still needs to use sunscreen.
True.
People with lighter complexions have higher risk. But higher amounts of melanin does not fully protect against sunburn or skin cancer.
That is a hard sell. I don't know if you've run across that in working with patients. It is a hard sell to convince people because of that myth that the darker the skin is, the less likely. And that's right. Just not true.
And you get very fair-haired people or red-haired people that very fair-skinned or red-haired people. They've got it. They know it because this is a daily concern of theirs. People with darker complexion, it is, again, there's less risk, but not zero risk. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly, I think most of the melanomas I've seen are in fair-skinned people. You can get melanoma if you're African-American as well. So it is not true that you simply don't need it. Number nine, even if they're using sunscreen, a person shouldn't stay in the sun all day. Well, true. I mean, better. We have disproved the maxim better living through chemistry. That is, whether it is taking a pill so you can eat French fries, whether it is putting chemicals on your skin so you can stay out in the sun, none of these things is a good idea. The American Cancer Society recommends seeking shade during peak sun hours, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Let me tell you something. If you are in the shade from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the chances of you getting a sunburn go down a whole lot, especially here in Kentucky. My wife and I absolutely do that. And before 10 a.m., it's pretty hard to get even to get your skin red at all from the sun. Mm-hmm. So I think that, to me, is the most sensible thing to say. Get out on the beach early morning hours, late evening hours. It's not as hot. It's not as uncomfortable. You have a lower chance of getting a sunburn, lower chance of getting melanoma, and you don't have to put a whole bunch of chemicals on your skin if you're out there, again, at 8:30 or 9 in the morning, or if you're there at 5 in the afternoon. Now, I know I'm going to get some calls on that because you're supposed to still wear sun protection no matter what. But for most of us who are not red-haired or extremely fair-skinned, if we would just stay out of the sun between around 9:30 or 10 and around 4:30 or 5, we would be fine. That is a very sensible thing to do. Number 10, using an indoor tanning salon to get a base tan is a good way to prevent sunburn. All right.
False.
The American Cancer Society says there's no such thing as a safe tan. A base tan provides little protection against sunburn, and any tanning injures the skin. I don't know how you get a base tan. I think that's, I mean, especially from a tanning bed. That's the thing. You go in there, and they've jacked up the bulbs. You know, new, more powerful bulbs, and so you have no idea. There's a little card on the side that's supposed to tell you how long you can safely stay in. But they've changed all the bulbs, so the card doesn't apply anymore. So it's just like, why don't you just go in and just roll the dice and see if you come out red or...
Well, and you put oil on to make it, you know, even more powerful.
We have no sympathy at all for that. The idea of a base tan, particularly if you get it indoors, is just ridiculous. So that's our sponsor. Skin safety, blame it on the melanoma, and blame it on station manager and our producer, Paul Hitchcock, for nitpicking that first question. I think we had a good question with lots of information there, and then all of a sudden it just goes sideways. There was no reason for that.
Yeah. Well, we took his microphone, and he still interfered.
Paul just sits, he's cackling over in the corner, and it does cause me concern. It's been good working here on Morehead State Public Radio. We've enjoyed our time here, and so I guess we're about to sign off. But before we do, I want to talk a little bit about some issues about our healthcare system. And this is, again, we're going back to school on healthcare system. And one of the most thought-provoking and, I think, provocative personalities in healthcare is a guy named Ezekiel Emanuel. He is Rahm Emanuel's brother. Rahm Emanuel was the mayor of Chicago. Also, I believe he was chief of staff for Barack Obama during the Obama administration. Ezekiel Emanuel, Harvard-trained oncologist, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He essentially, he was the top-ranking health official during the creation of the Affordable Care Act. In essence, he wrote the Affordable Care Act. There was an interview in the Health Affairs with Ezekiel Emanuel, and he said several things that I thought were worth talking about. First of all, they asked him to assess the Affordable Care Act. Now that it has been, we have been through the Trump administration, the Republicans have altered some of the dynamics. Was it worthless? Is it gone? Did it accomplish anything at all? And he said three things. First of all, 22 million people got coverage through the Affordable Care Act who didn't have coverage before. And if you think about it, our health inequity, our health disparities between rich and poor have been expanding. And without the Affordable Care Act, this could have been much worse. In the state of Kentucky, I believe it was 500,000 out of our 4 million population were able to get on Medicaid. It has revolutionized health care delivery in eastern Kentucky, I'll tell you that. I think so. Yeah, those are numbers and very hard to dispute numbers.
Well, and I think the critique we hear about those numbers is that coverage ended up becoming catastrophic coverage, but that's still beneficial. I mean, that's still better than nothing.
That's what he said. And in our case in Kentucky, although there were a group of people who managed to get in very high deductible plans, that is, they have to pay most by themselves. But if, as you said, in an event of a catastrophe, they do have insurance as a backstop. But we had a large number of people who got first dollar coverage at Medicaid, and that was a big help for our poor citizens in the state of Kentucky. Second point. It's made a huge difference in terms of cost and cost control. This is what he said. The Office of the Actuary at Health and Human Services projected health care costs for 2017. This was back in 2008 when they passed the law. At that time, they projected a certain dollar amount. And when we got finished with 2017, the actual expenses were $650 billion less than the actuary projected. Something happened. And it may have been, again, high deductible insurance is one thing. People are very concerned if they have to pay the first dollar of their health care. Mm-hmm. It may have been some of the economic setbacks. Although we have had an economic recovery, it certainly hasn't been uniformly distributed. And so maybe there's not as much money to spend on health care. But there is certainly some contribution to those cost reductions that we've had over the past 10 years. Coming from the Affordable Care Act. So I will give him that. I'm not sure. He says the accumulated savings have been over $2 trillion. And again, I would not attribute all that to the Affordable Care Act. Third thing, innovation has started. There have been a considerable amount of innovation in terms of payment models, delivering higher quality and so forth. And I will not give him that. I think there was going to be innovation.
Yeah,
you can't go 10
started.
Years in healthcare and not have innovation. So I am less impressed with that. Now, then they changed topics. And once again, he has some interesting thoughts. They said, well, what about the current Democratic idea of Medicare for all? We're going to provide universal Medicare type of health care for everybody. We'll get rid of private insurance, and that will be the government paid health insurance that we've longed for. And he said, and I want you to kind of burn these words into your heart, because I think he's absolutely right here. He said you've never seen a country put a $1 trillion industry out of business. And healthcare and health insurance is a $1 trillion industry. So for me, it's a non-starter. And I know this is going to upset particularly one of my former partners, Dr. Yule Scott, who is very, very much into a government-sponsored health care. I told him I would be glad to run the government-sponsored health care year two. But when you're closing down for-profit insurance companies and hospitals and so forth and putting those people out of work, someone else is going to have to accomplish that. And again, Ezekiel Emanuel says it just can't be done. This is the system we've got. We can adapt it, but we're not going to shut that industry down. And then he goes on to say Medicare fee-for-service. Fee-for-service means the more times I see you, the more money I make. Or the more doctors that see you, the more money that those doctors make. And he said, first of all, there are lower administrative costs if you do it all through the government. But again, the IRS becomes your fee collection agency if it is government. And also, he points out that if you have those lower administrative fees, they don't update the diagnosis codes. They don't update the payment system as certain diagnoses get easier or harder to treat. They leave that to private systems. And so they're not really a completely autonomous system. We would have to spend more money on administration. It's a kind of a weak argument. I think even then it would be cheaper if we had one system rather than a bunch, and even he says that. But well, his best argument is this fee-for-service stuff, people just see more doctors, and there's no coordination between the doctors. So they you see people on Medicare seeing 7, 8, 10 doctors, different specialists for different conditions, completely uncoordinated. Nobody's really looking to see if there's any overlap, and that is not good health care. He feels that a privately managed system paid for by Medicare, like a Medicare Advantage plan, would be better than simply just giving everybody Medicare as it currently exists. He thinks, though, that Medicare probably, in after the election, if the Democrats were to win the election, would probably become an option for people who couldn't get insurance elsewhere, is what he thinks will actually happen.
So what do you think the single-payer system, particularly if it's the government, what do you think that would do to evidence-based medicine?
I've had a problem with this. I think regulation stifles innovation. That's pretty clear. That is, if you want everyone to get the same health care, then you're going to go to a level of health care that's not very innovative, because that's the only thing you can do universally. So if you say, all right, we're going to, everyone is going to get to exactly the same type of health care, and we're going to mandate that, then the innovation stops. And I think in that sense, our healthcare system stalls. And we saw that with our electronic medical record. We mandated that everyone has an electronic record, all the doctors' offices and hospitals. And what happened was they put out a product that really wasn't very good, and it has absolutely destroyed the practice of medicine for people like me. I mean, this is the single biggest headache I wrestle with on a daily basis. So my thinking is, if it did come from the government, there would be much less innovation because they can't help it. They've got to regulate.
Well, do you think if we went to a single-payer government-based, do you think there would be a mechanism for collecting health records like they do in some other countries that would facilitate research and evidence base, or do you think that would just break down?
No, I think they could do it. What we need right now is one place to store our information. What Shelley's talking about is a lot of countries, they can go through and they can look at the records of everyone. So if they want to know how many people are dying of lung cancer or dying of inflammatory bowel disease, they can search the entire country. We have no such centralized record-keeping system. Certainly, if we had a universal government-sponsored health care insurance, the records would be centralized. I think you can say that. Innovation may slow down. Research, not necessarily research on how to be how to take better care of people, but again, research on diseases would be, I think, improved.
Yeah.
But you could have a central data repository without necessarily having government health insurance, I think.
Yeah, that's where I struggle with some of these plans, that these different plans that you hear individuals talk about. There's this disconnect between getting the best high-quality care to everybody. You know, all the pieces have to come together, and I just don't see a plan that brings all those pieces together that need to happen.
Yeah. I would say right now, you know, what I have heard, I cannot see it being a good system. I do not like what we're doing now. I in no way do I think we ought to stand pat. But he has some interesting points, and the whole concept of the more I see you, the more pills I get you on, the more surgeries I do, the more I get paid, is not a good system. I ought to be paid to protect your health, not to do things to you. So fundamentally, we've got to make that change. And he agrees, and I agree with that. And until we do, you know, putting in the current system, codifying that, making it the national standard is not good. I've got actually a couple more things from Ezekiel Emanuel. One very fascinating thing about his thoughts as he gets older that I want to we'll save that for our next fractional portion. So next time we'll continue with our discussion of Ezekiel Emanuel. We'll talk about his four policies for making healthcare more affordable, and also how he feels about healthcare after age 75. Why don't you pull together your opinions, discuss this among your friends and family, and take a break, because that's what we're going to do. And then we'll come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello, and welcome back to the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and this reminds me of freshman year.
Was that a good year? Hopefully that was a good year for you.
Back when I was in school, my first year, we call that my freshman year. And that's what we're talking about here. I mean, come on, people. Get your heads out of the cow pasture and let's talk about some funky music. Freshman. Thank you for that. This is a funky show, isn't it? When you think back in the 1970s we'll keep moving. Our sponsor for the final time, Skin Safety. Blame it on the melanoma. We will run through those. One American dies of melanoma, the most deadly type of skin cancer every day. That is true, but they also die every hour. There are 7,200 deaths estimated in 2019 from melanoma, and unfortunately, it does happen frequently to people in their 20s and 30s rather than to people as they get older. Number two, the people diagnosed with melanoma surviving 5 years has gotten better. That is true. We are getting much better at treating melanoma, but still, we lose around 6% of all people in the first 5 years who are diagnosed with melanoma. Number three, since 1992, prevalence has remained about the same. That is not true. It's one of the many things that bothers me about melanoma. In fact, as we have moved inside, the rates of melanoma have gone up. Also, if you look, the northern states have a much higher rate of dying of melanoma than the southern states. As a matter of fact, some of the lowest states, Arizona, Texas, California, they have some of the lowest death rates from melanoma. Now, it could be that this relates to the percentage of the population that's African-American or has darker skin, brown skin and dark-skinned people. Have lower rates of melanoma. Maybe all the redheads are, in fact, living in the northern states, but I can't accept that. I have not seen that really looked at, so I'm still trying to figure that one out. Compared to other cancers, melanoma of the skin is not very common. In fact, it is one of the top 10, as we mentioned. Women more likely to get melanoma of the skin than men. That is false. Men, in fact, are almost twice as likely to die of melanoma than women. Number six, if you spend a day in the sun and you're not Rick Phillips, you should use a 6-ounce tube of sunscreen to get you through the day. That is true. First of all, you shouldn't be spending an entire day in the sun. And secondly, you could spend a day next to Rick Phillips and then you wouldn't be in the sun.
This is true. Yeah, that's one approach.
The whole thing revolves around Rick, and I emphasize revolve.
And he's stuck in Isonville, so.
That's right. So if you're in Isonville, you can go without the sun. we digress. Number seven, waterproof sunblock. That's just a bad question. I'm skipping seven. Eight, a person with darker complexion still needs to use sunscreen. That is true. Nine, even if you're using sunscreen, you shouldn't stay in the sun all day. As a matter of fact, if you made a habit of getting inside by 10 a.m., of not coming out till 4:30 or 5 p.m., it would be much, much more difficult for you to get sunburned. And staying in the shade or staying indoors during that period of time. I think, you know, you need sunshine for vitamin D. I am not of the mind that a person should avoid the sun altogether, but you must avoid sunburns. Sunburns are very clearly detrimental to your health and should not do that. And I think relying on any chemical to allow you to frolic in the sun with no clothes on all day long is a bad idea. It's a bad policy. And finally, indoor tanning salon to get a base tan is a good way to prevent sunburn, and that is absolutely false. That's our sponsor, Skin Safety. Blame it on the melanoma. Back to Ezekiel Emanuel, and again, going back to school, that was kind of the why, that plus the fact that I thought it was absolutely hilarious. My wife and I so misunderstood each other about the term freshman year that I had to make a show title out of that. They asked him in Health Affairs this interview, and this was actually early August. They asked, how can you make American healthcare more affordable? And he had four policies. He said, one is we have to do something about drug prices. Drug prices right now, this is big business basically holding critically ill Americans at ransom. It's just, if you want this drug, you're going to have to pay $1,000 a pill for it. And that is unconscionable, but we have allowed that system to happen, and we have to shut that down. And that's what he said. Economic theory and practice tell us that it's a recipe for exploitation, letting the drug companies set their own prices, and we have to stop it. Even a 10% drop saves $50 billion a year. So we've got to do something about that. Second, cap hospital prices for private insurance. We have local monopolies. That is, the hospitals just they set their rates, the insurance companies do they do have a cap. But if you are a fairly wealthy suburban hospital, you're going to get paid more for every procedure. You're going to get paid more for every admission than a safety net hospital in a lower income area. And with that extra money, then you can sort of fake that you're giving better care. This bothers me. You never have a safety net hospital named as the number one hospital. In fact, I have serious reservations about working at a top-ranked hospital, because in order to do that, you've got to pocket a lot of money to put in the things that go into making the ranking. And so I would prefer working at a safety net hospital. I want to work where I'm needed. There we go.
that's your rant for
that's
for
my
today.
Rant that's absolutely. And then third, administrative simplification, and I think we can all get behind this. There is absolutely no reason you need an explanation of benefits, this is not a bill, this is covered, this is not covered, mysteries, is it covered or not, no one can tell you, just go ahead and do it and then we'll find out if it's covered or not. This should not be that difficult. Quite simply, we pay this much for this. That's all you need to know. And you need a bill you can understand. Here's how much you owe. Not how much you might owe after someone else might or might not pay, but just simply how much you owe. And this surprise billing, I think, is the start of that, where people get hit with a bill for $10,000 or $20,000 they didn't know was coming. But we've got to overhaul the whole process. He agrees with that. And then finally, continue payment reform. We've got to, I think it was Mark Twain, but I'm not sure. I do not trust a man who has a vested interest in removing my leg, a vested financial interest in removing my leg. And in fact, a surgeon has a vested financial interest in removing your leg. And that is not, you do not want that person near you. I want everyone around me to be financially invested in saving me, not taking
right.
me apart.
Preventative care, health promotion.
Yep. Final Ezekiel Emanuel controversy. He has said that he wants screening measures, health preservation, pacemakers, whatever it takes, within reason, to take care of him until age 75. He says, stop preventative services and curative care at age 75. And these people says, really? And he got very upset. He used words that I am not even allowed to use on the air, and I wouldn't, to describe the question. Are you sure, are you still sure you would stop care at age 75? No pacemaker, nothing like that after age 75. Yes. Now, here's what he's thinking. First of all, people say, well, people as they get older are happier. People in their 80s are very happy people. And he says, that is not necessarily true. If you think about it, if you are able to give an interview in your 80s, you are already a select person. There are many people in their 80s who are simply not physically or mentally capable of giving an interview. So when you start doing that, it's called selection bias. If you only interview the 80-year-olds who are at the gym, then you are going to miss the majority of people in their 80s.
Who can meet you for coffee out on the town.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Those people are happy. They tend to be upper income people, upper education people, and they have better health than the rest of them. And so if you took the broad expanse of people in their 80s, they are not necessarily doing it as well. So he says, I can't trust the stories that say that people in their 80s are happy. The other thing he says, and I think this is controversial, I'll read this word for word. Secondly, look at what most 82-year-olds are doing, even the ones who are mentally and physically functional. The New York Times had a story about the Fountain of Youth published just after my article. They went to a place in Arizona. They reported on a woman riding a motorcycle and a guy scuba diving in their 90s. These people are having fun, but they're not doing anything that is contributing new ideas, new contributions, or mentoring younger people. They are enjoying themselves, which is great, but not if it is all of your life. And this is the heart of this, personally. Ezekiel Emanuel says, personally, this isn't health policy. This is my personal policy. I personally don't want to just be a consumer. I want to be a producer. I think that's what gives my life meaning, producing new ideas and mentoring younger people. So his argument is that if your only goal in life is to have fun, that is not a worthwhile goal. Now, that will probably upset some of our older listeners. I am stopping short of saying that's my opinion, but I wanted you to hear Ezekiel Emanuel's opinion. We know that having a sense of purpose is really important to successful aging. And I don't think he's saying that. I think he says, look, there's no way you can have a sense of purpose in your 80s. I think it's just, he says, it's just not possible. That's why I'm stopping in my 70s. I'll stop at 75. I'll make it into the low 80s probably, and that'll be fine. But I think we all have stories of people who are doing useful, functional things in their 80s, but he thinks that the probability of that is just too low.
So he thinks people in their 80s are not useful.
Well,
as a rule.
Many years ago, Governor Lamb of Colorado said that old people had a duty, an obligation to get out of the way. And this was a very, very it cost him his career politically, really, to say that. That's why I am not saying that.
To get out of the way.
Well, not that I'm running for political office, but just simply saying, I don't think I have, in all truth, I have not made up my mind that this is correct. It is an interesting idea, and I do think that we know we spend too much money on the last years of life of people that really have not much chance of getting back to joy and to functional life, whether they're contributing to society or not. But I'm not willing to shut things off at 75. I've got a lot of my patients are in their 80s that I think are of value to their families, to their communities, and to society as a whole.
Yeah, it's complicated because people age differently, right? You can see two 80-year-olds and they are have completely different quality of life, completely different schedules, completely different activity levels. And I don't think I could draw a line in the sand and say, hey, this age is it.
And to give you an example, let's say that the value of your life depends on what you contribute to society. So let's say you're a pretty You go to do your job, and on weekends, you ride a motorcycle without a helmet. You're involved in a motorcycle crash. You have a brain injury. You become an organ donor. You have given a lot to society. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, let's say you take care of your health. You don't eat fried foods. You exercise regularly. You maintain a lean body weight, and you live to 90. Well, in essence, then, you have spent 30 years on Social Security, which could be used for other things, vaccinating kids if you want to do something noble or something like that. Mm-hmm. So who, then, is leading that life that gives back to society? I think this is an area where we have to be really careful. I cannot accept that our worth is based on how much we give back to society. I think that there is an intrinsic worth to human beings. I think as a healthcare professional, I've always wanted to protect and value that intrinsic worth. And so for me, I can't agree with him on that. And it's interesting. He's an oncologist. He's a cancer specialist. He deals mm-hmm. with people who are older. Mm-hmm. And he is also an ethicist, and he does not see an ethical problem with making these statements. And I do.
Yeah. It makes me squirm a little bit to be talking about, you know, at what age we don't have purpose or we don't have value anymore, because I don't think there's a clear cutoff.
Well, first of all, we got to ask what age do we have purpose?
That's true.
Mm-hmm. And so we have to be clear on that, and then we can start talking about when the purpose and value disappears. But from my standpoint, you know, I can see, I don't know, I think the best way for me as a physician is to start off with the assumption that all human beings have value to their creator, to their community, to their families, to someone, to something, and that it is not my position. Certainly, he says, I mean, he backs off. This is not policy, he says. This mm-hmm. is my own personal philosophy. I respect that personal philosophy, but mm-hmm. it conflicts with mine. Can't see it.
Well, and as healthcare providers, we have to understand each of our patients comes with their own personal philosophy of how they value themselves and how they value their quality of life.
Agreed. So with that, we're going to get off the air. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Paul Hitchcock, to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our toe-tapping Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. Listen to the show. It's WMKY.org, or visit us on Facebook, HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to this show. And remember this message from former Major League Baseball player Frank Thomas for our male listeners.
Health Matters can make you a big hunk who looks like he still might be playing professional sports. If your wife wishes you would use Health Matters like Frank Thomas does, you can text DONATE $50 to Morehead State Public Radio.
We will send a free radio show of award-winning Health Matters, the number one selling free testosterone booster radio show on Morehead State Public Radio.
Health Matters is a unique man-boosting radio show powered by RadioFin, a patented key ingredient clinically researched to help boost your testosterone levels, to help you feel stronger, leaner, with more energy and drive, more passion too.
Why not try a show and trust Frank Thomas? She will like it too. Remember, text DONATE $50 to Morehead State Public Radio to get a free complimentary Health Matters radio show this weekend.
These free radio samples are not available in stores.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.